Coming up on this episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
We have been taught to limit our political imaginations. We've been taught to expect too little, and we need to snap out of it. We have been mentally trained into a codependent relationship with people who represent systems that do not wish us well.
Hey everyone, it's Dr. Mark. As a functional medicine doctor, looking at hormones, organic acids, nutrient levels, inflammatory factors, gut bacteria, and so many other internal variables, it helps me find the most effective path to health and healing for my patients. But such extensive testing can be very complicated and time-consuming for both the practitioner, somebody like me, and our patients. But lab ordering became very quick and painless since I started using Rupa Health. I can order, track, and get results from over 35 different lab companies within a few clicks in one lab portal. And this means one invoice for all labs paid online upfront. Plus, patients get practitioner pricing and receive full patient support through easier personalized collection instructions, automated follow-up, super bills, and answers to testing questions, and so much more. And best of all, it's free for practitioners. So sign up free today. You can find out more information by going to rupahealth.com. That's rupahealth.com.
It's hard to overstate how important sleep is. Our bodies know this, and that's why we spend, on average, a third of our entire lives sleeping. Now, I've had my own share of issues with falling and staying asleep over the years, and as a result, I spent a lot of time optimizing my sleep, and one of the best tools I found is Bioptimizer's Sleep Breakthrough. Now, most over-the-counter melatonin products can actually cause you to overdose on melatonin, which can be kind of dangerous. Sleep Breakthrough, on the other hand, is melatonin-free. Instead, it gives your body the precursors to melatonin and the molecules that help your body produce melatonin naturally. That way, the body doesn't downregulate melatonin production and you don't become dependent on sleep supplements and you don't experience any sleep hangovers. With Sleep Breakthrough, you'll fall asleep in minutes and wake up feeling refreshed and energized. Now, Bioptimizers is offering my listeners 10% off Sleep Breakthrough. And if you buy two or more, you'll get a free bottle of Magnesium Breakthrough. This is a limited time offer, so go to sleepbreakthrough.com/Hyman and use the code Hyman10. And now let's get back to this week's episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
Hi, this is Lauren, one of the producers of The Doctor's Pharmacy, jumping in before we begin today's episode with a quick note for reference that the interview you're about to hear was recorded in September of this year, prior to more recent world events.
Welcome to The Doctor's Pharmacy. I'm Dr. Mark Hyman. That's pharmacy with an F, a place for conversations that matter. And if you care about our world today, if you care about the problems we're having and the things we're facing, whether it's our healthcare crisis, economic disparities, climate change, how to fix our broken political system, you're going to love this podcast because with a good friend of mine, someone who is running for president again, which is a very brave thing to do given the current political environment, Marianne Williamson. You probably have heard of her. She's been around for a long time and has added so much to understanding of ourselves, our own well-being, and has been a leader in the personal growth movement. So she's an incredible woman and has the courage to actually take on the conversations that are hard, but we need to have. And on this podcast, I'm committed to having a number of different candidates for president from different perspectives, and I will continue to do that. And I want to give Marianne a platform to talk about the things that really are important in our world today. So Marianne is a political activist. She's an author. She's a non-denominational spiritual lecturer, and she's the New York Times bestselling author of 15 books, four of them hitting number one, which is no small feat. Her career began in the 1980s when she became deeply involved with the HIV/AIDS activism. And she's been a longtime advocate for the LGBTQ community. She founded Project Angel Food to deliver meals to the homebound and be unable to shop or cook for themselves. And that organization has served over 16 million meals. I thought I was helping people with food, but that's a lot of meals. She co-founded the LA Center for Living, the Manhattan Center for Living, and co-founded the Peace Alliance. She's been a nonprofit activist throughout her career and has numerous progressive candidate summits and podcasts to encourage more women and progressives and many to run for office. She's lectured to hundreds of thousands of people on spirituality and politically progressive topics, sold over 3 million books, and has an extensive work with the ill and dying. She actually already ran for president once. You might have seen her on the debate stage in 2020 and is now a candidate for president in 2024. And an essential part of her platform is a 21st century economic bill of rights, a Department of Peace. What a concept. The Defense Department used to be called the Department of War, but I think we do need a Department of Peace, reparations for slavery, a Department of Children and Youth, and a just transition from a dirty to a clean economy. She's a progressive Democrat. Marianne proposes new economic beginnings, including universal health care, tuition-free college and tech school, and a guaranteed living wage. What a different world it would be if all that were true. She was born and raised in Houston, Texas in 1952. She has a daughter and was married and lives in London with their newborn daughter, Elizabeth. So she's a grandma too. Wonderful, wonderful. Congratulations on being a grandma. That's probably the best of all things. Welcome, Marianne. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Well, you know, one of the taglines for my podcast is, you know, conversations that matter. Martin Luther King said, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. And you have been anything but silent about things that matter. Your career as a spiritual thought leader, political activist, author, you really have done so much to facilitate personal and systems transformation on things that really matter. And in one of your main focuses of your 2024 presidential campaign is the idea of systemic change. So what do you think the most important changes we need to see in America today are?
Well, there is a cancer underlying all the other cancers. As you said before, there are so many areas of stress and breakdown, but it's like in the body with cancer. And you said, well, where's the primary site of the cancer? The primary site of the cancer is institutionalized corporate greed and the hold that it has on the U.S. government. So whether you were talking about environmental breakdown or or income inequality or food insecurity or inorganic agriculture or anything else, if you look deeply enough into the root of cause, into the level of cause, root cause rather than just symptoms, you see that there is an overreach by forces of capital that have no particular ethical sense of responsibility, or moral responsibility to people, to animals, or to earth. Yeah. And unfortunately, the governmental forces that should be protecting the American people from the overreach on the part of those forces are actually in too many cases enabling them, because those forces have such power in Congress that basically turn the U.S. government into a system of legalized bribery. So until we deal with that systemic issue, we will always be playing whack-a-mole, trying to fight them off here, trying to fight them off there. I don't think at this point we're so much fighting them off. We've gotten to the point where we're all excited and jumping up and down in excitement if we get crumbs from these people, if we get the slightest sense of negotiation. So
right.
The problem is, I see it.
I mean, that's a big thing. And I think, you know, there are a couple of things that have been captured that I think are responsible for a lot of the challenges we have. One is the political process has been captured by corporations, and Citizens United was a huge Supreme Court case that basically made corporations people and allowed for unlimited funding of political campaigns, which was already a problem, but it's become really a big problem. And the second is the capture of media and by corporations. And just from my own little sliver of the world, you know, pharma ads make up over 60% of advertising on television. And that only occurs in New Zealand and the United States. It's outlawed in the rest of the world. And it's not because they're expecting patients to go to the drugstore and buy the drugs. It's because it drives them to their doctor. And over 60% of the time they get prescribed the drug, and they know that. So I think there's some really big challenges around media and around the political process that have to be resolved. And I think it's almost sort of a catch-22. The people in power aren't going to make those changes, but those changes need to be made by the people in power. So how do we navigate that conundrum?
Well, I think we need to move beyond words like resolved. It's not going to be resolved. I mean, there was a point where, you know, where the Civil War, the shooting started, because it wasn't going to be resolved. And I appreciate the nonviolent but it's time for all of us to wake up to the fact it's not going to be resolved. You mentioned a couple of things, and you're certainly correct. First of all, it was, you mentioned Citizens United, and you are absolutely right the way you described it. It is not reasonable, given the current makeup of the Supreme Court, it is not reasonable to assume that we are going to be overturning Citizens United anytime soon. The only ultimate antidote to that is a revolution at the ballot box. Now, the second thing you mentioned was was the media. And this,
and that's just so people understand, because I think, you know, most Americans probably don't have a clear idea of Congress and how it works, but you have to have over a two-thirds majority in Congress to overturn a Supreme Court decision. Isn't that right?
No, overturning citizens, that has to do with what happens in the makeup of the Supreme Court. The problem is that because Trump was able to appoint three of them, there's a book by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse about the strategy over the years that led to this corporatist takeover of the Supreme Court. There is a solid corporatist majority of the Supreme Court now that basically just toes the line with corporate America. There are many tragic moments that led up to this. In retrospect, I think we'd all wish that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had retired and allowed Obama to put someone in there. They all just assumed Hillary would be the next president. Same goes for the fact that during a certain break, he could have gone on and appointed Merrick Garland. But it is what it is. So right now, no, there is no act of Congress that can overturn a Supreme Court decision. They can codify things such as right. with abortion rights, but they can't actually overturn.
Well, so they can do campaign finance reform, right? Which would in some ways not overturn the decision, but would actually kind of make it
only the Supreme Court can do that. But once again, we can override the nefarious effects if people will show up at the ballot box. It's time for the people to step in on all of this. Congress is going to do it. President is going to do it. And Supreme Court is not going to do it unless we get different people in there. And that would be represented by a revolution at the ballot box. Second thing you mentioned was the media. A lot of this stems from a 1996 Telecommunications Act, which I'm sorry to say was from Bill Clinton. And what this led to was the corporatization and monopolization of the big media companies. Before then, you didn't have even a term corporate media. You know, it didn't exist. In fact, when I was growing up, there was a law that said the same company was not allowed to own the radio station and the newspaper and the television station in a community, because they recognize the importance of diversification of opinion to a free society. Now, independent media is trying to fight against this, but you've got what is essentially what I often call a political media industrial complex. Also, when you were talking about Big Pharma, and I'm sure you realize this, until Ronald Reagan, pharmaceutical companies were not even allowed.
Yeah, I know. When I was in medical school, there were no ads on TV.
Absolutely. All that came from the orgy of deregulation on the part of the policies of Ronald Reagan. So this is all about neoliberalism, i.e. trickle-down economics, i.e. corporate rule. And that's what we are right now. And that's why we have to see it as not as complicated as it appears. It's kind of one problem. And the only, with many, many tentacles. And only the people ourselves can handle this now. The people need to step in. And if we continue to elect status quo politicians, all we'll do, even the best of them, we will slow down the catastrophe, but we will not turn around.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like you and Bobby Kennedy are on the margin of the process and are being excluded from it and actually are having a different voice. And that should be welcomed. It should be part of our discourse as a democracy. And the fact that people are being shut out of the process is a bit frightening. It's almost like an autocracy. And, you know, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, it happens on both sides. And I think we have to kind of recognize that we're in a moment where, you know, the average person really doesn't have an understanding or a voice of actually how to fix this. And when you say the ballot box, are you saying that by people voting in different candidates, we could make a big difference? Because many of the candidates are selected or pre-selected by the party. So they're not actually candidates like you or Bobby who are like, I always want to change and make great change. They're people who are kind of part of the system and they don't even get to vote for people who might be different because they never show up on the ballot.
20 years ago, people like you and me could say, I'll just vote blue. I'll just make sure the Democrats, and as long as the Democrats are in power, everything will be okay. We look at that as very naive in retrospect. People have to get involved on the level of the primary, because what you were saying is true. We need to look back at the farewell address of George Washington. George Washington warned us in his farewell address about the power of political parties. He said that they could form factions of men who were more loyal to their party than to their country. This is also why our second president, John Adams, said that he saw political parties as the greatest threat to democracy. what you have now is these political parties.
And by the way, George Washington voluntarily stepped down. And if anybody's seen the film or the play Hamilton, there's a great scene where he's, you know, and induces Alexander Hamilton to write his letter of resignation and his saying goodbye to the country. And he says, we're going to teach them how it's done. We're going to teach them how democracy works. I'm not going to hold on to power. And the king kind of goes, what do you mean? Who gets rid of power voluntarily? Nobody does that, right? And it was really,
it sort of gives me chills to think about it. Because there were many people in this country who would have made George Washington king if he had wanted to be king. But he recognized that there was an overriding principle here. This is what Donald Trump does not seem to realize. The principle of democracy is more important than any one man.
Yeah.
If we go back, however, the point of going back is to have a greater understanding of where we are now. So what's happening right now is not just that the political parties chop wood and carry water for these huge corporate entities. They are corporate entities. That's the problem that we have now. So they are claiming, based on nothing, entitlement to determining who the American people should consider qualified to run for president and even to be president. Now, notice what's happening here. They are seeking to supplant the will of the founders, because the founders said that in order to be president, you have to have been born here, you have to have lived here for 14 years, and you have to be 35 or older. If the founders had wanted to say you had to have been a congressman or a senator or a governor, one of them, they would have. And they purposely didn't. The way they do it now is mainly through character assassination.
Yeah.
Mockery, or calling someone a long shot. She could never win. She's an unserious candidate. When you look at candidacies like mine, standing for universal health care, standing for a guaranteed living wage, standing for tuition-free college and tech school, standing for climate emergency. Actually, I'm the most serious candidate. And they know that, by the way. So they call me unserious to sort of, it's almost like a cops and robbers show. It's a purse thief mentality. Look over here so you won't look over there.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, well I want to.
It's dangerous to our democracy.
I think you're right. I think we have a disengaged electorate. Voting base. And I think that a lot of people are disenfranchised from the voting system on purpose, the gerrymandering of districts to sort of exclude different people, to sort of leverage, you know, on both sides, whether Democrats, Republicans, you know, how it looks for them. It's kind of a mess. But I want to talk about what
I'd like to say something about what you just said. You just said the problem is that we have a disengaged electorate. I want to say as clearly as I can, if I have learned anything from my last campaign and this one, is that the people are not the problem. They want us to think the problem is people are disengaged. No, people are angry. People are frustrated. People are cynical. People are going into this emotional decline, not because they are disengaged, but because when they engage, they get so angry because they know on some level that their voices are being suppressed.
Yeah, so, I think that's fair. That's fair. That's fair. I stand corrected. I stand corrected.
The people are not the problem.
No, I don't think they are. I don't think the people are the problem. I just think people, it's just so frustrating. It's such a show that they're like.
I don't think disengagement, they disengage out of how painful it is to engage. And that's different from disengagement out of I don't care what.
Agreed. Okay. Agreed. Let's talk about your vision for America,
okay,
because it's a very compelling vision. And I want to start with the thing that I think our audience and most interested in is the food system. And the food system have written about extensively. Food Fix was a passion project book of mine. I have a nonprofit that works on policy change in Washington. I'm going there next week to meet with, you know, senators and congressmen and the White House to try to move things forward to change the farm bill. But it's a slog. And there's so many forces arrayed against it. And there's so many people profiting, at the expense, of so many. You know, we have an incredibly sick population. You know, six out of 10 Americans have a chronic illness. 93% of us are metabolically unhealthy. You know, kids, 1 in 4 kids have type 2 diabetes or prediabetes. It's tragic. Mental illness is staggering. And a lot of it's driven by our food system. And we see on one side, you know, people who are hungry, on the other side, the obesity crisis. And, what doesn't really get talked about is the root cause, right? And Biden recently is trying to advocate for reducing drug prices and pick 10 top most costly drugs and is trying to negotiate lower prices. And I'm like, that's just a dumbass idea, because why even talk about drug prices? Why don't we talk about the reason why people need those drugs in the first place, which is entirely preventable.
Hey everyone, Dr. Mark here. You know I'm always experimenting with the latest health advances, and I found that tracking my blood glucose is one of the most insightful and accessible ways to understand my unique reactions to food. Poor glucose control is tied to all kinds of issues like weight gain, fatigue, type 2 diabetes, Alzheimer's, heart disease, and stroke. But it can be hard to know exactly how your body's reacting to the glucose in different kinds of foods because we're all different. That's where Levels comes in. It's a state-of-the-art app right on your phone that pairs with a continuous glucose monitor to show you how food and lifestyle factors affect your health in real time. With Levels, I realized I could make helpful tweaks in some of my favorite recipes. For example, adding extra avocado and a few less blueberries to my morning smoothie kept my blood glucose smooth and even, while too much fruit and too little fat sends me into a spike. Right now, you can join Levels and receive an additional 2 months free on your annual membership when you order at levels.link/Hyman. That's levels.link/Hyman, H-Y-M-A-N. Your first purchase will include 1 month supply of continuous glucose monitors and a 12-month software membership. If you go to levels.link/Hyman, Levels is offering an additional 2 free months of their annual membership.
I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you don't eat a lot of rocks, and neither do I. And yet traditional supplements get their calcium from crushed rocks. That's right. But your body needs other vitamins and minerals to make the best use of the calcium it gets, essential nutrients that are not found in gravel. AllergyCal takes a different approach. Their calcium supplements are plant-based, which means they're a more natural source of calcium for your body. Plus, they take a multi-nutrient approach by adding in all the nutrients your body needs to increase bone density. With over 5.5 million bottles sold and a website full of testimonials, I definitely say that AllergyCal has social proof. But even more, not just one, but 3 clinical studies have shown its effectiveness in supporting bone density. Right now, you can get 10% off AllergyCal calcium supplements when you go to allergycal.com/Mark Hyman and use the coupon code Mark Hyman. That's allergyacal.com/Mark Hyman and use the coupon code Mark Hyman, all one word. And now, let's get back to this week's episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy. So can you talk more about how do we actually think differently about the food system and the food production system? You have a whole food safety and security plan to address this epidemic of obesity, heart disease, diabetes. What are your thoughts and visions for how we fix our food and a system? And then we'll get into the healthcare system, because that's another whole problem. Food system is driving people to healthcare system, and we have to fix, right. Also have to fix, right, the healthcare system.
And I said that actually on the debate stage in 2020, we can't just talk about healthcare. We have to talk about the fact that basically we have a sickness care system. What we have to actually ask ourselves, which you yourself just pointed out, is why is there such a higher level of chronic illness in the United States than in any other advanced democracy? And that's why my healthcare plan is called a whole health plan. The system as we have it today is stuck in a very allopathic model. You refuse to proactively create health, and then you only talk about how to suppress or eradicate symptoms once sickness arrives. That is very 20th century thinking. And that is why the political status quo is an inadequate mode of problem solving for the 21st century. As Einstein, never has it been more true when he said, we will not solve the level of thinking we were at. We will not be able to solve our problems today from the same level of thinking we were at when we created them. Now you go back to the same problem. Big food companies, big agricultural companies, big chemical companies. There are, 46% of the American urban water supply is filled with PFAS. The fact that children are still...
Explain what that is, because that's an important...
You could probably articulate it better. They're called forever chemicals. They do not break down. And now I first heard about them because of a company called Saint-Gobain, who recently actually did decide to shut down and go back to France. Thank you very much. That was just spewing PFAS into the water supply of Merrimack, New Hampshire. And there are all these heightened cancer rates and so forth. But now it's so ubiquitous that, like I said, you've got 46% of the urban water supply in the United States. The issue is now people know this. Now, it's interesting because if I may say so, even talking to you is interesting because they don't mind having Mark Hyman to the White House because Mark Hyman's a celebrity. So they don't mind. Well, and I'm sure that there are people there who are just so happy you came by. And they are so happy to hear you. And they probably even have you at a reception at the White House. This is how the Democrats work. The Republicans don't even let the problem solvers in. The corporatist Democrats let the problem solvers in a very performative way. So what's happening now is that we have in every area, it's not just Mark Hyman when it comes to food. We have the geniuses in every area. We have the people such as yourself in every single area who would know. They already demonstrate. They write the books. They have the foundations. They have the best practices. They know how to repair lives. They know how to repair the earth. They know how to repair the food supply. They know how to regenerate the agriculture. The problem is not that we don't have the problem solvers. The issue is that the people with solutions do not have the power.
Yeah.
And the people with the power don't need to hear the problem solvers, except to the extent... Right. So the Democratic ones will bring in someone like you, Mark. OK, hello. But what will happen is only so far as what you're suggesting does not undercut the bottom line of short term profits for their corporate donors. Then you're going too far. Then they'll keep calling you and schmoozing you. And you know, we're with you, Mark. But you notice 5 years later, nothing has really changed on a systemic level. And that's why we need that revolution at the ballot box. Those people are not going to change it. The Food and Drug Administration was established in the 1930s. And it has been for 50 years now, just taking its teeth out, taking its juice out, taking its power away to the point where basically their idea of problem solving is writing a polite letter to the CEO of the company. Maybe, sir, please, maybe would you consider doing better? And then people such as yourself have meetings with them and even they are getting it. But until you have the levers of power in the hands of someone such as a president who's going to say this stops and it stops now in a kind of Rooseveltian way, then the incremental changes that are represented even by Democrats having House, Senate and White House will not be enough to keep us from a catastrophic result.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like a catastrophe happening. I feel like I'm standing on a beach watching a tsunami coming in and actually nobody's paying attention and everybody's sitting on sunbathing and having a great time.
You are. This is why the richest among them are planning ways to head to outer space.
Outer space or New Zealand.
They basically already bought up New Zealand.
They already bought up New Zealand. Yeah.
Even the neocons. Do you know that the neocons have have all this land in New Zealand? These people I didn't know what they're doing to the planet. Yeah. And it's like, well, we'll get out in time.
Yeah. So the vision is clear. I mean, your vision is very well laid out. And we're gonna link to your website for president, which includes all your platforms and detailed descriptions of all your policy ideas, your breakdown of the problems. It's very thoughtful, very well laid out. And it very much actually represents, particularly in the food, agriculture, and health space, the values and the vision that I have. And I think, my challenge to you is, okay, well, let's say you get to be president, but Congress is still captured, right? Because, you could potentially get the nomination. You could potentially become president, but then you've got all the senators and congressmen who are captured by corporations, and you have to actually have Congress to enact laws. You have to have them to pass the bills. So it's kind of it's a tripartite system we have, right? The Supreme Court, Congress, and the White House. So it's like, how do you solve that?
Well, the president does not have a magic wand. We don't want the president to have a magic wand. What you call a tripartite system is we have a balance of powers. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. There is a limit to executive authority, but it is ultimately good for all of us that there is. The president, no matter who the president is hoping for a Congress and a Senate who will go along. And this is why I talk about this all the time. Don't just elect me. You've got to get in there on the primary level, on the congressional races and the senatorial races. Kind of suppression that you were noting of myself and another opponent, Bobby, in this race is It happens on the level of the senatorial and congressional races as well. The parties, and this includes the Democrat as well as the Republican, when they talk to someone about possibly running, one of their first questions is, can you self-fund? What that means is you have at least $1 million lying around that you could put into this. So how could we be surprised at the consciousness of the majority of people? Although at this point, the majority of people in Congress, although at this point, it's sickening and saddening to see the way the progressives will not exercise more spine and leverage in the face of corporatists, even in the Democratic Party. But that's kind of a different topic. My answer to you is, the Republicans of late, the more recent Republican presidents, certainly such as Trump, overreach and abuse the authority of the presidency. The Democratic presidents, however, won't use the entirety of the authority of the presidency. Even right now, the government has marching rights. If pharmaceutical companies spend even $1 of taxpayer money in developing a drug, which is essentially almost every drug in the United States, theoretically and legally, the government does have marching rights. They can march right in and lower some of those prices, but they don't, because in the final analysis, they don't want to piss off Big Pharma so much that they would come after them in the next election. So at this point, the issue is that we have to deal with the situation as it is. So what is the situation of the presidency? One of the things that I've said to people, which traditionally you're not supposed to say, but I do say to audiences, I am only running for one term, because what I want to do as president, you couldn't even think of doing if you were even thinking of trying to get reelected.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not talking about abusing the powers of the executive, but we're talking about using them fully. I would have the power to actually appoint heads of these agencies. You would not have a Department of Defense secretary who had been a board member at Raytheon, thank you. You would not have executives from Big Ag in the agricultural department, thank you. You would have, to be honest, people such as yourself, not just coming in to visit and to give advice, but actually empowered. And I would not only have that, I would have the power of executive order, although you don't want to govern by executive order, but when you need to. And then also, Mark, I would have the power of the bully pulpit. Notice what you and I are talking about here today. You and I are talking about the elephant on the table. The problem is not that the American people are not open to what you and I are saying. And that is true on the right as well as the left.
Of course,
the problem is the political system does everything it can to obfuscate so that the people aren't actually having this conversation. We not only need to have this conversation, we need to have it in the White House. At a certain point, and I know that you agree with me because I know that you have your own experience of this. At a certain point, you start to feel like I'm done trying to convince you. Please get up and let me sit there.
Yeah.
Stop
taking up the space and let someone who actually can get the job done.
Why am I wasting my time coming here? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's amazing. Let's talk more about the plan you have for how we transform our food system. You know, food production has been subsidized. We're subsidizing ultra processed food. It's the number one killer in the world today. There's no debate about that. It kills 11 million people a year. I mean, if we were so passionate about, you know, addressing COVID, we spent trillions of dollars to do it. And yet the biggest thing that kills more people than COVID ever will is staring us right in the face, and it's caused by food. So how do we change from the agricultural system to the food production system to the actual dietary guidelines, to what's in SNAP, to all the things that our government has actually leverage in, and to actually change the food system for the better?
Well, of course, it starts with agriculture, and it starts with the devastating effects of monocropping and everything that big agriculture has done. Whenever you make short-term profits for huge corporate entities, your bottom line, this means that you were willing to do so at the expense of the real principles of nature. Principles of nature, principles of agriculture, principles of farming have literally evolved on this planet over millions of years. Mm. And Big Ag came in and completely decimated the whole thing. Not to even mention how many lives they have decimated. How many people had farms in their families for generations? You know, you mentioned at the beginning how everything connects to everything. When I ran last time, I would talk to many mayors in small towns, and this is what they would say. They would tell me, well, before the 1980s, there were local banks and many more. And so a farmer would come into the local banker and say, I didn't have a great yield this year. And the banker was likely to say, that's okay, we understand, you'll pay me next year. So what happened was, in order to gain control for big ag, it had to be gaining control for big banks. Big banks would come in there. They could care less if a small farmer said, I didn't make my yield this year. The big banks would say, okay, you're just going to have to sell to the big agriculture people. And it's just one thing after another. Now, when I was
that was Earl Butz, right? Go big or go home.
Mm-hmm. So that's right. Go bigger. And he actually said that. Those were his words. That's exactly.
I know. I'm not making it up.
No, you did not make it up. Those were his words. He was the Secretary of Agriculture, if I remember.
Yeah, under Nixon. And it was because the food prices were going up. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted to bring commodity prices down. Mm-hmm. And he was worried about not getting reelected. So he basically empowered his agriculture secretary to move aggressively toward the centralization and industrialization of agriculture to bring commodity prices down, to actually bring food prices down, which would help them get elected. So it was all very nefarious, and it ended up the downstream consequences are just devastating.
Safety and well-being of the people on the planet. Okay, now
literally millions of people have died because of it. It's really frightening.
Thank you, and I want to say something. That's exactly what I mean. We need to go past beyond how we're going to resolve this.
Yeah, it's kind of murder in a sense. In my view, it's murder. I think we know the solution, and the fact that we aren't engaging in policies that are saving Americans' health and well-being is really criminal. I mean, it's really criminal that 75% of the budget of food stamps, which is $100 billion, goes to junk food, and 10% goes to soda, and the government is using taxpayer dollars to actually propagate the chronic disease, diabetes, and obesity epidemic, and killing so many people. That's just one example. I could go on and on, but it's
Mark,
funny.
I think that the leap, transition, transformation, evolution, whatever, of your own conversation around this actually is where our generation is. You cannot resolve. This is murder. This is criminal behavior. And it is systemic. And
I mean, it's pretty radical to say that, but I never said that before. But actually, I think it's the truth. As I think, I was thinking of like, what's going on?
I'm thinking about the conversation you and I've had on this. Yeah. And where we get stuck is when we say, but they're nice people. They're not, it doesn't matter that they're nice people. Tell the Iraqi people that George Bush was nice. It's irrelevant. These are murderous systems. Now, the issue is when, just like we have you being an example when it comes to food, we have the Mark Hyman.
Sorry to interrupt, but it reminds me of Hannah Arendt's book, The Banality of Evil, talking about Nazi Germany.
It is exactly Hannah Arendt.
I mean, kind of an obscure reference. Most people don't know what it is, but she was an incredible philosopher and wrote a book after World War II about how Nazi Germany happened. And
that's right, but she's so cute, little blonde girl with her leader voice. How mean could that family be? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll tell that to the boy in the striped pajamas. Okay, but let's go back a little bit. So you have, right, you should be hip to this stuff. We should not be vulnerable to this. Okay, hold on. So what you are in food, and this is a very important point, what you are in food, we have the people who are the same in agriculture. I met people in Iowa who felt so betrayed by Barack Obama.
Oh, God.
Because they said that he had come there. They explained to him what was needed. He understood. They said, I saw it in his eyes. He understood. He got to the White House and he did not do the things he had said he would do. The issue is not how do we do it. That we have in every area the people who know how to do it, the people who would know how to restore through regenerative agriculture, sequestration of the soil. That's not the problem. The problem is we need the levers of power in our hands. You know, it's funny. When I think of, and I say this too when I talk to people all the time, when I have a visual, Mark, of my 4 years, right? I get 4 years in the White House, right? This is my visual. I think of all the people that I meet out there, like yourself, in every area, they know what to do.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So this is my visual image of my presidency. I'm in the Oval Office. I open all the doors and all the windows and I say, come on in, guys. We have it for 4 years.
No, it's true. It's true. I think, I'm getting very inspired by this conversation, but, you know, I do know that the levers of power beyond just government, you know, the corporate levers of power are so big. And I don't know if it's just sort of my kind of skepticism, but, you know, as I've sort of dug deep into the food system and the healthcare system, it's so clear to me how there's a very deliberate, pernicious attempt to control the narrative and to drive the agendas that they want. And I think, you know, for example, the food system, there's many ways that they actually co-opt our minds and government. One, obviously funding political campaigns. Two, they fund all the professional associations like the American Heart Association, American Diabetes Association, Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Three, they fund social groups like the NAACP and Hispanic Federation to co-opt them and prevent them from speaking out, for example, about soda taxes. Four, they create front groups like the American Council on Science and Health that says smoking, trans fats, and pesticides are good for you. You know, and they sound great, like, but they're actually all very deliberate, and they fund nutrition research, quote, nutrition research, which is 50 times more likely to show a positive outcome for their product. Like if you, you know, look at dairy as a sports drink, you know, it versus an independent study, which will barely find anything positive for the processed food that's being studied. The studies are all co-opted. So our nutrition science is co-opted, our government's co-opted, the professional associations, the social groups, there's front groups. It's a very clear strategy. It's not like, oh, we just didn't know. We made Twinkies, but we didn't know they were bad for you. We're sorry. We're going to try to fix them. It's very deliberate. And it's something that most people don't realize. And this is exactly what we mean by corporate capture. It's not just of the government, but it's everywhere in society, whether it's medical schools, whether it's professional groups. I mean, you know, the American Family Practice Association basically was, given millions of dollars by Coca-Cola, right? And then a whole bunch of doctors quit because of that. And I resigned my membership in that too. So it's pretty nefarious. And how would you begin to sort of break through on that?
Okay, first of all, I want to say it's just a delight to be on the front row of the radicalization of Mark Hyman. And
this is not new. I've been this guy for a long time.
Please don't get me wrong. There's an important point here. Because this point is very important. I'm not saying you didn't know these things. I'm not saying you didn't say these things. I'm not. Please don't get me wrong. What I am saying is that there's a level of coming out in the public and just saying what is true. And the reason we don't, and the reason we sometimes take a while to get there is because what they then start to project onto us. Oh, Mark Hyman's really gone too far. Mark Hyman, he's really gone too far. And that's where we are. Enough of us who recognize what you just said to be true have got to be in solidarity with one another and support the candidates, whether me or anyone else. And in this case, to be honest, I am the only Democrat running.
Yeah.
Who is saying these things? I mean, Bobby Kennedy is saying the answer is the discipline of the free market. He keeps saying he's a free market capitalism guy. And if you don't recognize that unfettered, unregulated capitalism that has completely swayed from any moral center is the problem, then how are we going to fix it? So what we need, you know, once again, the president is not everything. The president is one piece of it, but a president is a big part of it. You know, we need a president who would basically give a thumbnail of what you just said at the State of the Union address. And I want to tell you something, and you know this from the success of your own show. When we have a president who is willing to say the American people will hearken to the message on both left and right, I believe this. The problem is not the American people. The problem is how much power those corporations have in Congress. So what's going to have to happen is that the American people are going to have to realize it's not enough for you to just show up every 2 years or 4 years, because those corporate lobbyists are in these people's offices all day, every day. And that's why I'm saying a revolution at the ballot box. And it has to be in the primaries, and it has to be right now. Literally right now. And if you're going to buy, you know, of course they say that anybody who challenges that bottom line is unserious or kooky or crazy or whatever they come up with, long shot, whatever they take to distract you. And we have to see through that and elect somebody who represents the real intervention that is needed now. The people need to step in, because corporations are basically not only controlling our democracy, but if we allow them to continue, destroying our democracy and possibly destroying a whole lot more than just that.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. You know, one of the things you do talk about, and I think it's really important, and almost none of the candidates talk about, is our healthcare system, not just giving access to people. I think that's, the arguments are, Medicare for all, or, let's restrict access because we can't afford it. Medicare is going bankrupt. And those are the sort of the right and left positions, but neither of them make sense. I mean, if you allow the open gate for all the sick people to enter into the healthcare system, it's just going to overburden it. The costs are going to go up unless you deal with the reason people are being funneled into in the first place, which is our chronic disease epidemic fueled by our food system. And in your whole health plan, The Cost of a Healthy America, you lay it on your website. I encourage people to read through it. It's very thoughtful. It's very deep. And you talk about, big food, big ag, and big chemical companies driving so much of the problem with our healthcare system, and that we can't just fix the healthcare system. We have to fix the reason our healthcare system is burdened. And it's not like we have bad doctors or we have bad science or we don't actually have capacity to actually do what's needed, because we're not actually addressing the root cause. And I think the beginning of this conversation, you talked about root cause analysis of the crisis in our political system, but there's also root cause analysis of what's wrong with our healthcare system. So can you unpack your vision for your whole health plan for America?
Well, you can't just treat sickness. You have to proactively cultivate health. So I want to be a president who not only provides greater access for people to get healthcare, but greater opportunities for people to live a healthy life. This has to do with lifestyle issues, even. This has to do with educational issues. This has to do with environmental issues. This has to do with food issues, which has to do with agricultural issues. This is why it's called the whole health plan. We need a holistic vision of the society. And this is why status quo politics, even at its best, is not capable of dealing with this, because it's very transactional. It is not transformational. All it does is to treat the symptom. So we have to stand back and say, okay, not just how are we going to pay for treatment. And I do think that's important also, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
It bears noting. I have had doctors say to me, two in particular. One was a doctor in Detroit who said 15 years ago, if I told a patient what the treatment was that I was suggesting based on their diagnosis, the question would have been, what are the side effects? Today, the question is more likely to be how much it will cost.
Yeah.
And same with the cardiologist who said something to me similar in Texas. He said, I don't even know why I bother to practice medicine anymore. People's insurance will cover the visit to the doctor, but under insurance, which is so prevalent, means the insurance will cover the visit to the doctor, but will not cover, for instance, the 18 million people in America who cannot afford the prescriptions that the doctors give to them, or the insurance will not cover the. So this Medicare for all issue is obviously very, very important. But once again, we have to ask ourselves, what will it take to create a healthier society? A lot of the obesity that you mentioned, of course, has to do with the fact that so many people, a lot of people, particularly these obese children, and I'm sure you're very aware of this, many of these obese children keep wanting to eat more because their bodies are going for some kind of calories. There are so many food deserts in this country where people don't even have access to healthy food, do not even have access to healthy water. They're not breathing healthy air. I'm sure you saw the article that sort of went viral recently. If you look at the ingredients in a bottle of ketchup in Canada versus the ingredients in a bottle of ketchup in the United States. But once again, as long as short-term corporate profit is your only bottom line, until we challenge that and really present to the American people what are our options? And our option is the kind of hybrid economy that you have in many countries in Europe, where they have far better. We are the only country, we spend the most and have the least results.
Yeah.
In terms of our healthcare system. And when you look at countries such as some of the Scandinavian and other Western European countries that have much, much better results, it's because they do not allow themselves to be tyrannized by corporate greed from either insurance companies or pharmaceutical companies.
No, it's true. I mean, our life expectancy is worse than all the rest of the world. And, we score lower on most health metrics than, you know, even developing countries, whether it's infant mortality, maternal mortality. Yeah.
We have over a million people who are rationing their insulin.
That's insane.
1.3 million. In no other advanced democracy are people rationing their insulin. I spoke at Cambridge recently. When I mentioned that people were rationing their insulin, I saw the disbelief on people's faces. This is only because of greed and big pharma. You don't have this where there's universal health care. You don't have people putting up GoFundMe pages for life-saving operations. But once again, as you point out so eloquently, why are some of these people so sick to begin with? Why is there such a high rate of diabetes to begin with?
Right. I think that's right. And I think, you know, you're not just sort of saying these things without deep thought. And I have to say, again, I was just very impressed with the level of detail, the specificity, and the kind of holistic thinking that was involved in creating the platforms that are on your presidential candidate website, right? It's food and safety security plan, the whole health plan, the climate action plan. It's marianne2024.com. It's like the number 2024.com. I encourage you really to take a look, because it's hard to argue with what she's saying. And I'm newly radicalized. Well, I have to say, I wrote a book 20 years ago where I talked about the toxic triad, big food, big pharma, and big ag, that was driving our disease epidemic. And this was in 2003 that I wrote this book. And now it's 20 years later, and it's worse than ever. I mean, then I wish we could go back 20 years. It would be amazing. But it was bad then, and it's much worse now.
You know, the election actually that was stolen was the election of 2000. Mm-hmm. If the man who was actually elected by the people, Al Gore, a world-class environmentalist, had been president in the year 2000, it's one of the great tragedies of human history, actually.
Yeah, yeah. He was selected, not elected, right? Selected by the Supreme Court. Yeah. Tell us about your thoughts about climate, because I think it's a complex topic. I think this has been a very intense year of fires and floods and, you know, droughts. And I mean, it just seems to get worse every year. It's almost like we're becoming numb to it. Like any one of these events would have been a giant story. And now it's just like every week there's something, right? And can you tell us about how you're thinking about this problem? You know, Robert Swan said the greatest threat to our planet is the belief that someone else will save it. And this is a global problem that requires global action. And, I know John Kerry well, and he's been, you know, really working hard. He's almost 80 years old, and he's like working really hard, running around the world, trying to make a dent. But how do you see?
His frustration has become obvious, by the way.
Yeah.
In much the same way that you've described in your own experience. So I am in New York City right now for Climate Week. I do believe that the environmental movement has been successful, particularly with the maturing of this younger generation, at creating a critical mass. Going back to the way the corporatist Democrats will always, where we are with them is they'll say the right thing. So the president will, for instance, say he's the climate president because of the healthy investments in green energy in the Inflation Reduction Act. The problem is all of the benefits of those investments are completely nullified by the fact that the president has approved the Willow Project, by the fact that he's given more oil drilling permits even than Trump did, and by the $858 billion defense budget, given that the Defense Department is the single largest institutional emitter of greenhouse gases on the planet. What I will do, President, not only cancel the Willow Project immediately, but all the $8 billion ConocoPhillips oil extraction project up on the North Slopes of Alaska, but also declare a climate emergency. When you talk about trying to negotiate with these people and how deep-rooted the corruption is, a climate emergency will actually give the president the capacity to not just invite people into their office and say, hey, guys, let's talk about it, but actually say what's going to happen. I'll give you one of my favorite stories from FDR. At the beginning of World War II, when Roosevelt, you know, his eyes are open, he's getting what's really going on here. There was a tremendous isolationist tendency in the United States, understandably, based on World War I, but we're starting to see what is really going on. Hitler had spent 5 years building up his military capacity. And every time he invaded a country, he was able to absorb their industrial power. Okay, we had nothing. We had basically nothing. England had nothing. Roosevelt calls the head of the big three automakers, the same people, you know, same groups going on in UAW strike right now. So he calls the head of the big three into his office in Washington. And he says, gentlemen, I need this many ships, and I need this many tanks, and I need this many planes. And the head of the big three automakers said, President Roosevelt, we are patriotic Americans, sir, and we will support the war effort. And as soon as we sell our quota of cars, sir, you will have those ships and you will have those tanks and you will have those planes. And Franklin Roosevelt said, gentlemen, I don't think you heard what I said.
Yeah.
I need this many ships. I need this many planes and I need this many tanks, and you will not sell another car until I have them.
Yeah.
That's what it means to declare a climate emergency. And that was necessary because World War II was an emergency. This is an emergency. So we need a mass mobilization for a just transition from a dirty economy to a clean economy. And we need it now. We need to ramp down fossil fuel extraction now. And that is the kind of president that I would be.
No, I agree 100%. In fact, I was on Tucker Carlson, who's the only person who would actually let me talk about these issues on media because he wasn't co-opted. He's sort of an independent loose cannon, whether you agree with him or not. He gave me an hour uninterrupted, essentially, to unpack what's wrong with the food system. I said, this is a national emergency, what we have going on in healthcare with the health of Americans. You know, we're seeing 93.2% of us are in poor metabolic health. That means 6.8% of Americans are healthy. That is a national emergency, in my view. You know,
this is an emergency, a national emergency, a global emergency, a species emergency, and we're like the frogs in the boiling water. But it's not, you know what? I don't even think it is like the frogs in the boiling water. I think it's worse than that. It's more like the crabs trying to get out and being pushed down by these systems that I don't know. I don't really know what they're thinking, because I don't care how many billions of dollars you have. If the shit really hits the fan, there's no amount of money that can protect any of us from what would occur.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of float around in different circles. I mean, what are you hearing in the back rooms and the private conversations?
They know we're right. Yeah. They know we're right. These are all some of the people who run the world and are handling some of the most nefarious systems are some of the smartest people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And right. Sometimes, and this is where you have to really, like, being nice, it becomes irrelevant.
Yeah.
And we have to, you know, it's funny, Vivek Ramaswamy, who is now running for the Republican, I mean, he's so far out there, right? And he said to me when we were both on the Bill Maher show, he said something like, well, I really like you. I think you'd be a great president or something. And I said, well, I'll tell you this much. If I'm ever president, you are going to pay much more in taxes. And I think that's where it comes. It comes to saying people very nicely who we like. Like, boy, yeah. you're just not going to be able to do that anymore when I'm
president. Yeah. No, it's true. I think, you know, nice isn't necessarily the problem. See,
like, it's like George Bush, like I said, ask the Iraqi people.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, this, in my view, there's this sort of what appears to be the people who run the world, and then there are actually the people who run the world, right? And I think that's what's invisible, and it's this invisibility that's the problem, and it's not, you know, it's not something that most people understand.
But really, I don't think it is a covert conspiracy. It's an overt conspiracy. People just have to be willing to turn off mainstream corporatized media, read books like yours, read independent media. It's actually very overt. And they're not hiding. They're behind their gates, definitely, but they're in the Hamptons, they're in Montecito, they're in Sun Valley. I'm sorry. We know this. You know this.
Yeah. I know. But I don't think, I maybe phrase it a different way. I think there is a sort of this collective group of humans who are very small, who all hang out, Republican, Democrat,
yes,
different countries.
Davos.
Yeah, it's like, Aston. It's like, yeah, so they all know each other.
They're not hiding, actually. Yeah. They're there.
Well, they're hiding from America. The average American doesn't see them, doesn't go to those places. You and I pop in and out and we kind of get to see it.
But it's actually, you know, I've been in some of these meetings, you know, and it's like there's 200 of the most powerful people in the world. Like, the, you know, the weekend with Charlie Rose, I went, you know, went to one of those after it was Charlie Rose because they took him off. But it's like, oh my God, I'm like looking around the room and it's like world leaders and politicians and Davos, all the billionaires. Yeah. And it's like, okay, wow. You know,
one power great enough to intervene and to cut the cord, that codependent relationship, which at this point is almost master-slave at this point. And that's, like I said, a revolution at the ballot box.
So what does that look like? Tell us about that concept of a revolution.
Well, in my case, I mean, this sounds a little self-serving, but in my case, it means donate and volunteer to my campaign and vote for me. But I'm not the only candidate who is speaking this way. In many ways, Cornel West's views align with mine. Of course, I'm running as a Democrat. He's running as a Green candidate.
Yeah.
So somebody could, you know, vote for me in the Democratic nomination, and they could vote for.
But that's just at the top of the ticket. What about all the
same thing is being mirrored on the congressional levels and on the senatorial? But you have to really listen to people. You have to really ask people questions. You have to actually ask what they actually stand for. And I think that's where I do think a lot of people need to exercise more critical thinking. Because if somebody names the problem but then thinks the only answer to it, even take someone like Robert Kennedy, he's been an environmental lawyer. He understands the nature of the problem. But when you ask him what's the answer to the climate crisis, he says, the discipline of the free market. Mm. Are you kidding me? Mm. He says, I'm a, you know, free market capitalism guy. So he's throwing his bones to, you know, the libertarians and the far right wing extremists. But this isn't personal. But there are serious disagreements here of opinion. But people have to involve ourselves, and we have to realize that. You and I were talking about it off camera. At this point, the era of data collection is over. You've written the books in your area. The data, no more data to be collected. The issue now, do we have the courage? Do we have the bravery? By the way, these forces, as huge as they are, they had been pushed back before.
Yeah.
We answered slavery with abolition. We answered the institutionalized oppression of women with the women's suffragist movement. We answered segregation with the civil rights movement. We answered the first Gilded Age with the establishment of organized labor. It's just our turn now.
Yeah.
And I know it's hard. I know it's, you know, despairing. But, you know, there's a saying in AA, you get sick and tired of being sick and tired. And you said something earlier. You said, I feel like I'm sitting on a beach just watching a tsunami coming. Mm-hmm. And that's really the question right now. Are we going to watch this tsunami coming, or are we all going to get up right now and say, no, it's the 11th hour, but it isn't midnight quite yet.
No, no.
And there is still time, but we've got to stop electing the status quo politicians who will at the best give us the kind of incremental changes. And that way we will still hit the iceberg. We'll just hit it a little bit later and at a different angle, but the ship would still go down.
Yeah. You know, I hear you, and I still feel a little discouraged. You know, my friend Tim Ryan, who's congressman from Ohio, was running for Senate, and he was way ahead of the game. He was running against J.D. Vance, who is a very strange character, who flip-flopped completely from who he used to be to who he is to get elected. And you know, he was winning, really winning. And then Mitch McConnell threw, you know, tens of millions of dollars to the opposition candidate, and the Democratic Party kind of left him high and dry. And it was sort of super depressing, because here was a candidate who had a vision, who understood the issues, who wrote a book about the food system, who understand climate issues, who understood the mental health crisis, who understand the challenges of our economy. And he was just kind of couldn't get in. Like, he just couldn't get in. It was so tough.
I think it was one of the mysteries of that election season that the Democrats did leave him high and dry. But it was also my impression that Tim, and this is not a criticism, but it does seem to have been his choice that he also played along where he thought it would serve him too, and it came across a little wishy-washy. I think that was true of Mandela Barnes in Wisconsin as well. If people would just claim their unabashed progressive vision and say it like it is, you'd be surprised at what we could make happen in this country. if those of us who believe that actually support them.
So let's just close with a sort of recap of your hope and vision for the future and how we restore our individual and collective health, because I think we've covered a lot of ground, but it's okay. I think I want to end on a note of vision and hope.
The way I see it, the American people need to claim the possibility of a repaired world. Americans were born out of a big dream. Americans are characterologically hardwired to dream big. And when we do not dream big, something starts to wither inside us. We don't dream big collectively anymore. We've actually bought into the notion that the only people who get to actualize their dreams are the people who have the money to do so. And the only people we see actualizing their dreams are people who have big money. So we're numb and we're thinking, well, maybe if I make enough money, I can actualize my dreams. That's not the American dream. The American dream is not that you can have yours. The American dream is that we can stand for a greater possibility. And that is what needs to be reclaimed. We have been taught to limit our political imaginations. We've been taught to expect too little, and we need to snap out of it. We have been mentally trained into a codependent relationship with people who represent systems that do not wish us well, that are morally neutral. And an amoral system inevitably produces immoral results. This is now our lives we're talking about, the lives of our children, the life of our ecosystem, the life of our democracy, and if we're not careful, what could become the habitability of the planet for the species. It is that serious, and I think if all of us who believe this will actually stand on what we believe and claim the possibility of tikkun olam for repairing this world, we can do it. Americans, you know, Churchill said, you can always count on Americans to do the right thing after we've exhausted every other option. Historically, it is true of us. We often get there late.
Yeah.
We're often too distracted or too easily fooled, something. When it happens that Americans wake up, we slam it like nobody's business, and it's time for us to do that now. We, the people. Jefferson said the only safe repository for power in this country is in the hands of the people, not the hands of the government, not the hands of the corporations, in the hands of the people. And it's time for we, the people, knowing that we are no longer functioning as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. We are functioning as a government of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations. We are not functioning as a vital democracy. We are a vital oligarchy, and it's time for the people to step in. It's our turn now. And when we awaken to that and are willing to stand up and to say it and to do it and to put our feet behind it and to put our money behind it and to put really our lives and our sacred honor, as our founders said, then we will turn this ship around in time. And it'll be one of those political miracles for which America has historically become quite well known.
I'm surely hoping for that. You know, one of the things we didn't talk about, which is I think, the undercurrent of what's happening, is that there's so much division in the world and so much kind of tribalism and mutual hatred and lack of mutual understanding and inability to have conversations with people you disagree with, and the cancel culture and the woke culture. And I mean, it's so pervasive. And I think in my view, it's partly been propagated by digital persuasion algorithms that capture our mind and make us believe things that aren't actually in our best interest and that drive us to behaviors that aren't necessarily in our best interest. And it's kind of this invisible force out there that, whether it's intentional or not, that's what's going on. And I think some of it has been intentional. I mean, it is deliberate. The cyber attacks, cyber security is a real issue, not just, you know, getting your computer hacked, but your mind hacked. And I think this is what the Russians, the Chinese, the Saudis are all potentially doing to us. And I think, you know, when I think about this problem, I'm thinking, well, how do we solve that? Because I feel like it's this invisible problem that is there, that unless we figure out how to solve this tribalism, we're not going to get better. And I just got back from Dharamsala when I met with the Dalai Lama, and I got to see one of his monks, create a school called the Tonglen School, where he took kids off the street who were living, you know, basically in slums, and brought them in, gave them housing, gave them shelter, gave them food, gave them an education. And what was really remarkable was they created a curriculum called Secular Ethical Emotional Learning. And they, these kids in there who, you know, literally were, nobody in their family was educated. They were all living, you know, in poverty. They were all beggars, were talking about, you know, how to identify their emotional state, how to have conversations, how to be kind, how to, the importance of compassion. There were textbooks of compassion. There were textbooks on dialectics. How do you have a debate with someone where you come to a sort of a conclusion that, you know, is based on logic and reason? We've lost all that. So part of it has to do with this sort of digital persuasion economy and this sort of tribalism. How would you, as president, heal that divide that we have in this country? Because unless we do that, I feel like we're kind of at each other.
Yeah, a lot of what you just described that sounds so beautiful to people like you and me and to your audience, that's what Ron DeSantis calls woke. Mm. And he would say Florida is where woke goes to die, canceling any problem, any programs that have to do with social, emotional learning, etc. This is what I believe, however. Even that division, the culture war division, has been purposely stoked between left and right. It is artificial. What they don't want us to see is that the real axis is not between the left and the right. The real axis is between the powerful and the powerless, between those who have access to unbelievable sources of capital, and I mean huge multi-billion dollar sources of capital, versus those who are simply struggling to get by. I think that people, we are living at a time, Mark, where there is an interesting rumbling under the surface. It is pre-earthquake. There is a realignment of political dynamics going on right now. And people on both left and right are coming to understand it's not the people on the right who are ruining my life. It's not the people on the left who are ruining my life. If you are a working class American, when no matter whether you're on the right or the left, you're being screwed by the same people.
Yeah.
And so what we do is speak to truth. What happens when some people are telling a big lie? You've got to tell big truth. And what the corporatist elite, even on the Democratic side, have done, they tell the truth, but not the whole truth and not nothing but the truth. And I think what you and I try to have a conversation when you talk about Martin Luther King, things that matter. If we're going to have a conversation about things that matter now, we have to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I wouldn't be running if I didn't think there was a critical mass of Americans ready to hear that. You know, this is why in my case, for instance, it's not an accident that CNN isn't having me on. It's not an accident that MSNBC isn't having it on, because these corporate powers know this. They know that we would start a wildfire. And those of us who are saying these things, if the majority of American people got to hear them. And my faith is in the American people. My faith is in the power of truth to tear down any wall. And when a radio talk show host in Las Vegas, Nevada said to me recently, he said, "Ms. Williamson, I agree with everything that you're saying, but how do you convince, you know, the average American?" And once again, I don't stand for that. I pointed out to him that this country elected Lincoln. This country elected Lincoln twice. You know, I had a dinner with a woman the other night. Well, I won't go into that. Well, I could, because you're laughing. I mean, she's a supporter of mine, but she voted for Trump.
Yeah.
And she said, if you're not the nominee, I'm going to vote for Trump again. When you actually talk to people where they live, we're not as divided as.
No, I agree. I 100% agree.
Confused, and the dots have been so disconnected.
100% agree. It's like, how do we begin to have those conversations? I want to just kind of close the story. That was one of the most moving things I've ever seen, which was a white supremacist who was a young man who was the voice of the white supremacy movement, a very smart guy, well-educated, who had very structured beliefs about, you know, the fact that whites were superior to other races. And he had his facts in line. He had his data. He had his statistics. He really deeply believed this. He was brought up in that world and that culture. And I mean, he wasn't someone who wasn't educated or aware. And he went to a college for some reason that was not a kind of right-wing kind of white supremacist college. And he was kind of ostracized. And there was a Jewish guy who said, hey, why don't you come over for Shabbat dinner? And he came over and started talking to him. And they would just meet regularly, and they would sort of exchange ideas, and they would, you know, talk, and they would kind of, and he sort of basically almost got him deprogrammed by just having, you know, deep conversations backed by evidence. And eventually he changed his mind, and he became now someone who's sort of, you know, speaking out against the problems of white supremacy. So, you know, you take someone who's so entrenched, so hardened to a particular belief, when you humanize them, when you know, he's like hanging out with a Jewish guy who thought was like an inferior, and he's like, this is his buddy now. It was like, I invited him in. It was kind of like almost like a spiritual chiropractic adjustment in his mind that helped him actually understand that, you know, we're not all that different, and there is,
that's
a value around equality.
Almost spiritual. That is spiritual, actually.
Yeah. So it was. I've seen this happen a number of times, and so I feel like if we just can sit with each other, if we can just kind of look in each other's eyes, if we can humanize each other, and people say, how are you taking care of this person because he's a Republican, or how are you doing taking care of that person because he's a Democrat, or why are you taking this care of this Muslim, or why, like, people kind of say stuff to me, and I'm like, you know what? I'm a doctor. I take care of human beings. Everybody's a human being first, and then they're whatever else. Then they're a man or a woman, or they're white, or they're black, or they're whatever beliefs they have. Like, that's kind of my view. And then, and I have friends from, you know, who I don't agree with on all these, a lot of things, but that we understand our common humanity. And that's, I feel like, we have to get back to.
That kind of smug arrogance, projection onto other people that they don't share our values, is something that infects the left as well as the right.
Oh, 100%.
I think we all have to get off our high horses. No one has a monopoly on truth. And nobody's tribe gets to own this country.
No.
We have to find that sweet spot, the Rumi idea, out beyond all ideas of good and bad, right and wrong. There is a field. I'll meet you there. We need to meet there, and that is where solutions will come from.
That's right. That's one of my favorite poems. We'll maybe put it in the show notes by Rumi. It's, you know, out beyond the ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there's a field, I'll meet you there. And I think that's exactly right. You know, that's exactly right. Well, thank you, Marianne, for having the courage and the tenacity and the grit to actually go out there and do this job, because I'm not sure I would. And I hope all the success to you. You have all the success, and you keep putting these ideas out there, because whether or not you get elected or not, I think these are really important conversations to have that are marginalized. And it's why I think the podcast world is so great, because, you know, it's almost like media has kind of gotten sidelined, and more people listen to podcasts and are looking at alternative media than are actually watching television anymore. So it's almost become irrelevant.
That's why I'm so grateful to you for having me.
All right. Thank you, Marianne. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. If you were inspired and interested in this conversation, I encourage you to share with others on social media. Leave a comment. What are your views? What do you think about all this stuff? We'd love to hear from you. And subscribe to Every Gear Podcast. And we'll see you next week on The Doctor's Pharmacy. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Hyman. Thanks for tuning into The Doctor's Pharmacy. I hope you're loving this podcast. It's one of my favorite things to do, and introducing you all the experts that I know and I love and that I've learned so much from. And I want to tell you about something else I'm doing, which is called Mark's Picks. It's my weekly newsletter, and in it, I share my favorite stuff, from foods to supplements to gadgets to tools to enhance your health. It's all the cool stuff that I use and that my team uses to optimize and enhance our health. And I'd love you to sign up for the weekly newsletter. I'll only send it to you once a week on Fridays. Nothing else, I promise. And all you have to do is go to drhyman.com/picks to sign up. That's drhyman.com/picks, P-I-C-K-S, and sign up for the newsletter. And I'll share with you my favorite stuff that I use to enhance my health and get healthier and better and live younger longer.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Just a reminder that this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or other qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Practitioner database. It's important that you have someone in your corner who's trained, who's a licensed healthcare practitioner, and can help you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.